You're listening to the Property Nomads podcast, your one-stop shop for property, business and travel-related content, tying it all together to help guide you towards success. If you like the podcast, please share with others, subscribe and leave us a review. So get your gear together and let's get going.
Welcome to episode 99 of the Property Nomads podcast. Today's guest, as I promised last week, today's guest is the number one best-selling author of Expat Secrets, How to Pay Zero Taxes, Live Overseas and Make Giant Piles of Money. He hosts a popular podcast, The Expat Money Show, on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, and is a director at escapeartist.com, the world's oldest offshore website. He has travelled to more than 100 countries, including North Korea, Zimbabwe, El Salvador and Iran, lived overseas in 8 countries, and has circumnavigated the globe more than 400 times. He can help you to internationalise your life and business by legally utilising the offshore markets to reduce your taxes, protect your assets and regain privacy and control over your life. Please welcome to the show, Mikhail Thorup. Mikhail?
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you very much for the nice welcome. I'm sure that was a lot to read. You might need to take a glass of water.
Definitely. I think I've got a dry voice after. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I am based out of Panama. It is a beautiful day here. It is very, very hot. But no, it's good. Things are good. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for taking your time. And just for the audience, we've got some really exciting extra content at the end, some really cool things that are coming up. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss them. But let's go straight off the bat. What is an expat?
Okay. I get this question all the time, and I think it's really interesting. And I think it's not just so much interesting because of the word itself. I think it's interesting because of the connotation that a lot of people have. Now, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, an expat, an expatriate, they're over here to steal our jobs, and it's only, it can only be white men, which I don't know where this came from. It can only be white men, and they're over here to steal our jobs and steal our women and all kinds of weird stuff. All right. That's not the case. An expat or an expatriate is just someone who lives overseas outside of their country of birth. And the distinction between that and, say, an immigrant is an expat will often live in a second country, a third country, a fourth country, or they will return home to their original country. So, for example, I'm a Canadian citizen born and raised in Canada. And since about, you know, my teenage years, I've been living overseas, but I didn't live in one country thinking that I was going to migrate there and I was going to spend the rest of my life there. I've actually lived in, and you briefly touched on it, I've lived in more than 8 countries around the world.
What's your favorite one?
Right into it, eh, Robert? You know, all right. Favorite country for living in or favorite country for traveling to?
Questions. Let's do, go answer both of them, because I imagine the answers would be quite different.
Yeah, they are very different. Okay, I had a great time when I lived in Australia. I lived there from 2006 to 2009. It was just a special time in my life. I was in my 20s. I was having a lot of fun. I was making tons of money, more money than I could possibly spend. The food was incredible. I lived in Melbourne, so the food was just unbelievable. Really nice coffee, really nice wine, and just a high standard of living, which I really liked. I found in 2006, my money went very far. Now, I've been back to Australia many, many times since then, and I know the prices have gotten out of control there. I know the country's got a whole bunch of problems with the government. They can't seem to figure out who they want to lead the country. Every other day, they're changing politicians. It's a bit of a mess over there. But while I was there, it was an amazing experience. Saying that, I also lived in the Middle East for 8 years. I lived in Abu Dhabi from 2011 until about this time last year. And wow, that was a really interesting experience. And, you know, I'm happy to dig into life in the Middle East and what it's like to build a business and invest in the Middle East, you know, anytime through this conversation. But just really quickly, I'll say that the Middle East is really not what most people say. And a lot of people who make comments about Muslim countries and about the way that they treat the women or your freedoms or your rights is based off of stuff that they see on CNN or some other junk like that. It's not based on real life, you know? I feel like I have a very good understanding of it. Like I said, 8 years in the country. I also traveled to Oman and Bahrain and Kuwait and Egypt and a whole bunch of countries in the surrounding area, as well as all over the middle, all over the UAE. So that's, I guess, kind of from the living side. But I guess all of the places that I've lived have had a special place in my heart. From the travel side, it's a little bit more difficult. You know, I think at last count, I've been to something like 104 or 105 different countries over the last 20 years. And, you know, the countries that I pick as my favorites are not really the countries that a lot of other people might choose. For example, like, I really loved my time in Iran. Once again, people get it so wrong. They think that Iran is the axis of evil. And, you know, these people, they want to steal your babies and kill one another, and it's a war zone. It's like, no, that has nothing to do with reality. There's some problems with the government, like most countries in the world. And, you know, there's some very strong embargoes in the country, but it is not a war-torn country. The women still have rights. You can still drive there. You know, and then add to the fact that the country is just stunningly beautiful. Like the natural beauty there is unbelievable. The people are warm and generous and want to get to know you. The language is actually very interesting. It's Farsi. It's not Arabic. It's a different language. It's a different people. It's a different culture, different heritage, history, everything. But that kind of gives you a little bit of a couple of examples of the things that I'm into, which often are quite different than just the tourist areas that a lot of people see. Does that make sense?
100%. And that was one of the joys of reaching out to you in the first place to get you on the Property Nomads podcast, was that traveling aspect, not your traditional places. I imagine you have been to some sort of traditional places, but yeah, things that are a bit more off the bat. And we, you know, we love that. These are values that we hold true and dear to, you know, our hearts at the Property Nomads podcast as well. In terms of mass media, I totally agree with you on that. If we believe everything we read on stuff like CNN or BBC and whatnot, you know, no wonder people are given the wrong perception of things. It's not surprising. That's why I don't really read much of the news, to be honest with you. I will touch on traveling again, I'm sure, in a bit as we go through everything. We're going right back to the start. We've gone through what an expat is. So, how to use offshore markets to internationalize your life. What gave you the idea to come up with that phrase in the first place? And just for people that might not know what one is, what is an offshore market?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think vocabulary is really important. And I think that the words that people use to describe things and their lexicon is really beneficial to go over. So you can think of an offshore market or an offshore jurisdiction as really any place outside of your country of birth. Now, it doesn't have to actually be on the other side of the world. A lot of the largest offshore markets are just south of the United States or south of Canada, where I'm from. But often they have these couple of things in common. So usually there is very favorable tax laws, if not zero taxes. And when I say taxes, I'm specifically referring to income tax, corporate tax, things like that. Sometimes the country still will have a VAT or some form of a sales tax, but usually very, very low or zero tax. They have very strong asset protection laws where your data, your information is private. So the company registry is often very private. And so those are two of the really, really big things. And a couple of examples of countries like that, and these are some countries that I really like, might be Belize, which we do a lot of work through. You know, it's an English-speaking country. It's just south of Mexico. It's a very strong offshore jurisdiction. We do companies and banking and self-directed IRAs that get worked through there. And then from there, you know, places like Nevis, you even have in the UK, you know, like Gibraltar or Guernsey and things like that. On the other side of the world, you have the Seychelles, you have Vanuatu, which is another popular one with people with second citizenship that I'm working with at the moment. But even countries like Hong Kong and Singapore would be considered an offshore jurisdiction. So there's really a lot of places. And I think if we tallied them all up, you might find that it's actually about 30 or 32 countries. When you consider there's really like what, 193 sovereign countries recognized by the United Nations. You know, that's a pretty good chunk of the world that could be considered in the offshore markets or offshore jurisdiction.
Why do you think people, and again, this might be down to mass media as we've just touched base upon, what do you think many people, the perception that common perceptions of offshore markets do when you're speaking to people who aren't as tuned in, shall we say, do people just think it's another sort of illegal scam? Are people very suspicious because it involves practices not in their own country? What are the sort of common barriers you hear from people when you mention about offshore markets and banking?
Well, you know, I'm very fortunate because I run a pretty venomously strong libertarian list. So if I get the leftists on my list or on my podcast who think that everybody needs to pay their fair share of taxes, you know, I actively try to push people off of the list like that. Now, obviously, I'm on your podcast right now, but, and I'm not sure what your the leaning in is for your list. But I would challenge people when they look at taxation, what the money actually goes to. So as a libertarian, the two tenements that I really follow are do not encroach on others and do all that you say you will do. So basically this means, you know, don't rape, steal, murder. And if you say you're going to do something, do it, which is the basis for contractual law and the basis for tort law. So we follow, you know, old English common law. That's the most easily understood. But socially, we're very left, and economically, we're very right. So the majority of people who think that everybody needs to, and I'm going to do some air quotes here and no one can see me, but anyone who thinks that you need to pay your fair share of taxes might think that the majority of their money goes to social structures like the road system or the hospitals or socialized medicine or anything like this. Well, you know, that's really not true. And I would challenge people to go out there and try to find information of where tax dollars really go. Now, I'll use the U.S. as an example because it's the markets that I'm most familiar with. The majority of my listeners and readers come from the U.S. But you can figure that a very, very, very large, and I don't have the statistic in front of me, but a very large percentage of the money goes on defense spending. Defense is a funny way of saying drop bombs on women and children in foreign countries. And as a libertarian, I am really against this. Like, I'm not a pacifist. If someone punched me in the face, I'd probably turn around and punch them back. But I mean, you know, if no one has ever hurt you or ever harmed you, I don't see why you should be invading their country. I don't see why you should be going after them. So I actively find legal, and I will emphasize this, underline this, legal ways to reduce your tax bill. And the best way that I have found to do this is to move your wealth offshore. And we talk about this stuff in detail on my podcast, The Expat Money Show, or on my website, escapeartist.com. And like you mentioned, we are the oldest offshore website in the world. We've been doing this for more than 23 years. I took over the business last year, and we are doing amazing. And during this coronavirus, you know, there is so much stuff going on. So many people who understand that government is not our savior. Government is the problem, not the solution. And there's just so many things that are happening, so many exciting, exciting things. And I know we discussed it very briefly before we pushed record today, and we can get into it in a little bit, but we're holding a massive online summit that's going to be happening June 1st. And I would really invite your listeners to come and take a look. And I'm sure that you'll be able to link to it in your show notes at the Property Nomads website.
Yeah, everything that we mentioned today will be in the show notes. We'll do a special blog article as well. So all of that will be linked into the show notes. And yeah, I do think I'm going to say it's scary. I think that's going to be the best word I'm going to use. I think if people knew how the world really worked, and, you know, pardon my French, it's fucked up. And not many people will ever take the time to really get to know how it works, because, you know, sometimes we might never truly, truly know. But there's a lot of things out there that, if you study geopolitics and macroeconomics, as you obviously do, when you start realizing how the world works, it's... we don't live in a very homogenous society, and people that think we do are, I think, a bit batshit crazy, to be honest. But that's my sixpence for you. In terms of moving overseas in the first place, obviously, you know, visited over 100 countries, lived in over 8, as you say. What gave you the idea of doing that in the first place?
So my story, to tell my story, I have to go a little bit backwards in time. And I promise I won't make it too long, Robert. But this might also answer a lot of questions why I am so passionate about what I do, and hopefully answer a few other questions along the way. So when I was a small child, I was diagnosed with a learning disability. And I remember one day, the principal and my teachers and a couple of resource teachers, they came to me and they sat me down, and we had this big meeting. And they said, Mikkel, something doesn't work quite right in your brain. You imagine I'm like 6 years old or something, like hearing this. How scary that must be. Something doesn't work quite right in your brain. And what we want to do is we want to send you to a special school for special boys. And that's what they did. They put me on a little white bus. And every day for 3 years, I got on a little white bus and we drove across town and they put me in a special school. Now, you might be thinking, well, that's not so bad, you know, a special school and, you know, some extra attention and yada, yada, yada. But really, Robert, that's not what it was. It was actually a special class in a regular school. Now, if you think back how children are, especially 6, 7, 8, 9, this kind of age, kids are mean. Kids are really mean, especially for someone that they don't understand or things they don't understand. So I was in a little class with 12 people, and then we had, you know, a couple hundred kids in the rest of the school. So I would get in arguments and fights and picked on and bullied every day for 3 years. And, you know, this is not a woe is me story. You know, I came home crying, although I probably did most days. You know, I gave back a lot of what I got, but I decided, or I figured out, is maybe a better way to put it. I figured out at a very young age that school was not for me. So what did I do? At 12 years old, I stopped going to school. And of course, I started failing, and I failed, and they'd try to send me to summer school, and then I'd go a couple of days, and then I'd stop going to that, and I'd fail again. Well, by 12 years old, I just stopped going. And at 15, I had officially dropped out, and I never went back. And I started traveling not long after that. And I would go overseas, and I would meet these incredible people, these people who didn't know that I had some, you know, scary learning disability and something wrong with his brain. They just knew me as Mikkel, and just how I spoke and presented myself and my ideas. And I was based off, I was judged by my actions at that time. And I ended up making these incredible friends. And I really felt like this was the first time that I really belonged anywhere. And I didn't feel like that where I grew up, which is kind of funny when you think about it. I had to leave to figure out where I belong. Anyways, I decided that I was going to dedicate my life to this. And I started traveling in my teenage years, solo traveling around the world. And that's what I've done. Literally for 20 some odd years straight now, I have been in continual travel. Now, like I said, I lived in Abu Dhabi. I was there for 8 years. But I mean, every couple of weeks, I was flying somewhere. I've had different businesses. So that's allowed me to travel. When I was 19, I took 18 months and I hitchhiked through Central and South America, you know, all over the States, Mexico, Belize, all of Central America, Colombia. I took a yacht to Colombia. I was there for 2 months. I had spent 2 months in Morocco in a trip before that. Where else was I? Spent 5 months in Guatemala living there, studying Spanish and spending time with the local families and local indigenous people. I lived in New Zealand for a year. I lived in Australia for 3 years, Singapore for a year. I lived in the Arctic for 366 days, which was a very bizarre yet interesting experience. And I've really based my entire life on living this type of lifestyle. So I'm not like an armchair writer or author who talks about going overseas or being an expat or being a nomad or things like this. This is just who I am. And I've been doing it since the year 2000. So that's kind of a little bit of my history and story in a nut. But to kind of tie things back on why I am such a strong libertarian is because I look at public education really as indoctrination. And the government has an agenda. And if you don't think that the government has an agenda, then really, I need you to open your eyes, because it's really all around you and the information is out there. And whether you come to me for information or you find it anywhere else, you know, that's all right. It doesn't matter to me. The point is that you look at the systems that are out there. And government-run schools are based on indoctrination. They want to have people that can go out there and do specialized work to a high level. But then outside of their realm of expertise, they are helpless. They don't know how to cook. They don't know how to clean. They don't know how to take care of themselves. They don't know how to do critical thinking and problem solving and decision making. That's not what they're looking for. They want you to go out there, have your job, come home, buy stuff on Amazon, watch Netflix, and go to bed and ask as little questions as possible. Now, I think with coronavirus, you will see a giant resurgence of people thinking for themselves, because it is so blaringly obvious what is happening in the world that the situation is not what we are being told, that media is not telling the truth, the government are not telling the truth. And this whole process starts with public education. Okay. So because I left public education when I was 12 years old, I was not indoctrinated. I was not brainwashed to the same degree that other people were. And honestly, Robert, I am very grateful. I am very grateful that I was so brave to leave school at that young of an age, because I understood that school is not for everybody, that this is not the way it's supposed to be, and that there are alternative ways to educating yourself and learning. Now, the way that I learned was through experiences, reading, and mentorship. And we can go into any or all or none of these things. It's up to you. But I have very strong feelings about each.
Well, that's, number one, that's really insightful. Number two, having recently come out as being autistic myself, I can sort of put myself in your shoes when you talk about having a learning disability. I completely understand that sometimes you want to feel that you need to get away from things to discover yourself. So, you know, I admire you for that as well. And I agree with what you say. I do think the traveling aspect helps us to have many new experiences. And going back to what we said earlier on, things don't really work in the way that we're indoctrinated to believe that they are. And it's when you have to be inquisitive and you have to ask questions and you have to sort of really go, you know, deep down into what's going on. And the answers can be quite scary once you realize how the world actually works. I don't know if that's something you agree with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I write a lot, like a crazy amount. People don't understand how much content I put out, but I send out basically a daily newsletter with original content every day. I do a podcast. I write several special reports on different topics, which I think are beneficial to the readers, that go out every single month. I have an online bookstore, which you can find at escapeartist.store, with all the reports. We've been doing a webinar series right now, a paid webinar series that has just gone through the roof, which I'm so amazed about. And then the massive summit that I talked about. But what is funny is I send out this content, and I try to challenge people's beliefs on what is happening in the world. And the response I sometimes get is very negative, actually. And I don't blame those people. I get death threats. I get people telling me they're going to come to Panama and find me and beat me, you know, like really violent things, you know, and it's not me. I know it's not me. It's that someone has spent 20, 30, 40, 50 years believing in one system. And when you challenge that and you poke holes in it, they see that, you know, maybe things are not like they were led to believe in the first place. That can be really scary for people, you know, and they get really emotional and they don't know how to deal with it. So they lash out and they blame me. And, you know, I think that if you find other, you know, outspoken people in the industry, they will have similar experiences to me. And that's okay. You know, I don't really mind. I would mind if someone came here and, you know, attacked me or something. Please don't do that. But I mean, like, you know, if you can't handle these types of truths about what's happening in the world, what's happening in the government, and how your tax dollars are being spent right now, and you've spent years of your life working in servitude to the government, you know, that can be a lot to process in a very short amount of time. So maybe people are tuning off. Maybe, you know, and we've not even gotten into any of the really deep stuff. This is just the couple minute conversation, you know, but go out there, educate yourself, learn, you know, the more information you have and the better you are to understand and process information, I think the better off you're going to be.
I just think we should get part two booked in. This could go on for a while, but it's really fascinating because we're singing from the same hymn sheet. And I do think that people, if you've been ingrained into a system for so many years and then you're told by some outspoken person somewhere that this is what's going on, etc., etc., you know, people just revert to the five stages of grief. And the first one's anger, I think. So yeah, people are naturally going to get angry, you know, angry about that. I understand why people would. Deep diving, let's make an attempt to deep dive into the, I mean, this is all good stuff. Let's get into the Expat Secrets book. You say you're a very keen writer and that shows. The topic of offshore markets, internationalisation, etc., can be quite complex. Is it your goal, is it your mission to make a complex subject quite straightforward? Because it shows in the writing and it's really understandable.
Yeah, and it's so funny, you know, because I published this book, and if you go on Amazon and you read the reviews, it's really funny because some of the reviews are, I've been an expat for 12 years and I didn't learn anything from this book. Therefore, it's a scam. It's like, this book is not for you, first of all. second of all, you didn't even read the thing. Actually, I had one guy track me down on Facebook to tell me that he bought my book on Kindle for like $10, flipped through the book in 5 minutes, and there was absolutely nothing of value in it. Therefore, he reported me, got his money back, but still proceeded to berate me. I'm like, okay, first of all, if you want me to write a 600-page book in detail of forms that you need to fill out and different tax laws, I can do this. I promise you, I can do this. But what good is that going to do anybody? No one wants to read that kind of crap. People want to be, first of all, inspired, and second of all, have a glimpse into this world. So listen, the book, I think, is written in 18 different chapters. Each chapter touches on one section of the offshore market. Then from there, there are links from the book that will take you to additional resources. So if you need to learn about digital security or passports or second citizenships, things like that, there's additional reading and resources that come with the book. You have to open your computer though, and you need to like take the 10 seconds it takes to type in the URL. But I mean, it's there, and I show you exactly where it is. And this is not like, I'm not talking about citing other people's information. This is additional content that I created that I can now update as the years go by, you know, because these laws, these processes, these things actually change very often. So if I put it in print and put it up on Amazon, you know, that's kind of immortalized. That's how the law was that day. But with online, I can change those things very fast. They can become very nimble. But, you know, we can get into detail about any of the subjects. I think that a lot of people really enjoy hearing about the second citizenship and passport. You know, I'll put that out there for you, Robert. If you want to dig in, we can do that one. But otherwise, choose any of the other topics and let it ride. Let's go for it.
Yeah, well, I like the idea of citizenship. My other half's Mexican. That's a conversation we've been having for a little while now, is UK, Mexico, any other country, etc. But let's pop onto the subject of citizenship. Why would someone want to take citizenship in another country? And if you've got any examples of people that you've helped, you know, feel free to pop them in as well. That'd be nice.
Yeah, absolutely. So There's many reasons that people are going to want a second citizenship, and we can get into the different ways that you can acquire citizenship afterwards. But one of the first things that you should understand is there can often be very large tax benefits from having a second citizenship. And, you know, I'm not going to give individual tax advice by any means on this call. Especially because of the US system, which is, there's basically like the rest of the world and then there's the US. There's really two tax systems, and I can get into either or, but I prefer to stay on the big picture. So why would someone want a second passport? Well, there's going to be the reasons, you know, personal reasons. I want to live in the country. I feel a strong connection to the country, the culture. I want to identify with someone from that place. You know, you said your significant other is from Mexico. Maybe that is a way to bring you closer together. Maybe that is a way for you to understand and get to know her culture and her parents and her extended family, you know, being Mexican yourself. But let's talk a little bit about the ways that you get citizenship, because I think that this is really interesting, because it seems to be like this mystery, this secret sauce of how it works. But I'll try to break it down. You mentioned before, I try to take these really complex ideas and put them into really easy to understand. So here's my attempt. There are three main ways that you can get a second citizenship. And by second citizenship, citizenship leads to passport. Passport is just a travel document. What you really need is citizenship. This means that you are from that country where you have the same rights as everybody else. Actually, I don't know in any cases in the world, maybe there are some, but I've never heard of them, where it actually makes any difference whether you are a nationalized citizen or if you were born there. But a citizenship will allow you to vote, to live there full time, to build a business, to buy property, you know, build a home, all of these types of things. But the three main ways that you're going to be able to do this are the quick way, the quick way, the cheap way, and the lucky way. Okay? So let's break into this. The quick way. The quick way is what we call CBI, citizenship by investment, CBI, citizenship by investment. And what this means is making either an investment or a donation to a foreign country in return for citizenship. Now, you might think that this is some type of a scam. Someone paying for a passport? How could you do such a thing? Citizenship is sacred. How could you do this? Well, listen, it's not the case. There's many countries in the world who offer this. One of the largest countries, the largest programs in the world that do this is the United States, okay? So, you know, these dirty immigrants who are entering our country and taking all our jobs, well, that's not really the case. A lot of times, citizenship by investment in the United States is the EB-5 and some other programs that go with that. You know, it's several hundred thousand dollars to get a green card, fast track to a green card, which leads to citizenship. Canada is another popular country where you can pay to become a citizen. Now, there are passive programs and there are active programs. Now, a lot of these types of programs, they talk about different types of systems. Okay, so we have products like that or programs like that, Canada, the US. But what if you're already from one of these countries? You know, maybe you're Canadian, you don't want American, you don't want Canadian. Well, there's actually a lot of programs in the Caribbean. And these kind of start around the price point at about 100,000 US. And like I said before, they're investment, but really don't think of them as an actual investment. It's an investment where you don't get your money back. What you get is the citizenship and the passport that comes with that. Now, this ties back to the offshore markets. A lot of the Caribbean countries are offshore jurisdictions, so they're tax-free countries. So you can have a citizenship from there, run your business through there, and if you're not living in your country of birth, you know, if you're a digital nomad or you're living in a third country or even living in that country, you can often eliminate your tax bill. And I mean, eliminate it legally. I don't mean, you know, in some funny, dodgy, gray, black type of way. Legally eliminate your tax bill. This is the tax law and we just follow it. So there's several countries in the Caribbean. They all start at around $100,000. Then you have programs in Europe like Malta and Montenegro, which is a new one, which we just started working with. Cyprus, you know, but those programs get a lot more expensive. So some of them can actually go up to 2 million euros, actually, to get citizenship in a place like Cyprus or Malta and things like that. But then you even have programs in Austria. And get this, Austria's program is 10 million euros. 10 million euros to get citizenship. But this program sells out every single year. So there are people out there who buy this. So this is kind of a very quick breakdown of a couple of the programs that are citizenship by investment, CBI. Now, that's the quick method. This takes, you know, anywhere from 8 weeks to maybe 6 months, maybe on the long end would be a year. But what if you don't have $100,000 or €1 million or 10 million euros to spend? Maybe you want to do things the cheap way. So the cheap way is getting residency and living in the country for an extended period of time. So let's take Panama, where I live currently. Panama is about $5,000-$6,000 to have the residency here. This allows me to live in the country full time. I have a multiple entry visa. I can come and go as I want. You know, I own a company here and bank accounts, and I can buy property and I can do all the things I want to do, but I don't have citizenship. I don't have the ability to vote. I don't have the passport as a travel document. What I have is the opportunity to live here as much as I want. And it's a very cheap process. But now here is the best part. After 5 years of permanent residency, I can apply for citizenship. So for $6,000 in 5 years, I can apply for citizenship, get a passport that I believe Panama can travel to 151 countries visa-free, including the Schengen area. You know, it's, if not tier A, about as close to tier A citizenship passport as you could possibly get. Plus, it's a beautiful place and I really love it here, and there's really amazing, cool people. But there's a lot more residency programs out there than there are citizenship, direct citizenship by investment programs. So that's the quick method, that's the cheap method, and the last one is the lucky method. And the lucky method is being born to being born in another country and growing up in a third country. So for example, your parents decide that they want you to have U.S. citizenship, and this might be lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it. I would probably argue this one is the unlucky because of worldwide taxation. But anyways, they decide that they want you to have the land of opportunity, so your mom flies over to the United States, gives birth to you, and then goes back to the country that you guys are actually from, and you spend your entire life there. So you can actually claim citizenship there. So that might be considered lucky. The other way is your parents were born in another country, a second or third country, or even your grandparents. So say, for example, your grandparents are born in Ireland or Poland or Italy or several other countries around the world. You can actually still today claim citizenship, even if you have never been to the country. How amazing is that? You might actually have what we would consider like a free citizenship. You just have to pay the government fees, but you're not paying the $100,000 or even the $6,000 to have a lawyer do it for you. It's a pretty straightforward process. Might take a bit of time, but it's certainly not that 5 to 10 years for naturalization. The other way that would fall in the lucky is being married to someone from the country where you want to get citizenship. Now, this doesn't work for me. My wife is from mainland China, and Chinese do not allow for dual citizenship. And even if they did, they would not allow for citizenship by marriage. But in a lot of countries in the world, this is applicable. So that's kind of a very quick breakdown. There's obviously a ton more to it on what type of documentation you need to provide, your record, your income, and each program is slightly different. But I work with a lot of the lawyers who actually worked with the government to set these programs up. As I said, the summit that we're having on June 1st, I have half a dozen different lawyers that are coming on and talking about different programs, residency or citizenship, and the different ways that this helps with taxation, with asset protection, how to go about these types of things. And you can work with them, or you can work with someone else, or you work with someone like me who does this stuff for a living. So I hope that kind of makes sense. And I know that's a bit of a whirlwind there, Rob, but so that's citizenship by investment in a nutshell.
It's all fascinating stuff, Mikhail. It really is, because there's so much to see and do out there. And I think it's, from being in, you know, the property industry in the UK, a lot of people, not just in property, but I mean, starting business ventures or you know, considering moving or whatever, there's a lot of fear that comes into it. I moved from Reading to Hull a few years ago to be closer to investment area, and that's 3.5-4 hours up the road. But for a lot of people, I mean, to me, that's not a big deal. But to a lot of people, that's a big deal. It was, you know, it's all, oh, I mean, you know, you move into the north of England and, you know, we're never going to see you again and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, that's just 4 hours up the road. So moving country, what are the sort of, you know, people, you know, normal people might just blow their minds at the idea of trying to get bank accounts in different countries, maybe dealing with a different language. You know, people come up with a list of excuses of why they don't want to do it. What are common reasons that you hear, or common concerns you hear from people when people first start talking about the potential of getting dual citizenship or moving to another country?
Well, I think that in a lot of cases, and we can use the citizenship by investment as an example, I think that the pain point needs to be there. You know, people don't spend this type of money just because, you know, they want to be like James Bond or Jason Bourne and have multiple passports and travel the world. You know, that's kind of cool, and it's kind of cool to think of yourself that way. But I mean, 100 grand is a decent amount of money. You know, for a lot of people, that's actually a lot of money. And certainly 10 million euros, that is, there's no question, that is a lot of money. But if your pain is big enough, trust me, this is a solution that makes sense. We work with a lot of high net worth individuals. We work with a lot of people who own businesses. Now, if you have your business online and you're based out of, you know, Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, it is very likely that you're paying, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50% of your income in taxation. So think about this. You run $1 million business and for, you know, you pay $300,000 in tax a year. You know, suddenly that $100,000 for second citizenship doesn't sound that expensive. It actually sounds like a really good deal, you know? So first of all, you have to understand that this is not just your average Joe, you know, working a 9-to-5 corporate job or blue collar job that's going to run out and do these stuff. It's often, you know, investors, it's often entrepreneurs, it's often people like this. But a lot of the excuses that we do hear come into play is, and this goes for everything in the offshore markets, not particularly citizenship by investment, but with the language, with the banking, with the offshore incorporation, with the moving overseas, is either I'm too old, or it's too complicated, or it's too scary. Like it's too dangerous. Maybe that's a better way to put it. It's too dangerous out there. Okay, listen, I've traveled a lot, like really a stupid amount lot. Even at this point in my life, I feel like I've traveled a lot. The world is actually like quite safe. It's actually a really nice place. It's really nice out here and people are quite good and down to earth and happy. Like, listen, everybody wants the same couple of things, okay? Everybody wants a roof over their head. They want a full belly. They want to be loved. They want to have friends and family around them. They want to feel safe. Everybody is the same. I don't care if you are tall, short, gay, straight, black, white, male, female, anything like this, young, old, it doesn't matter. People want the same things. We want to be loved. We want to be safe. We want to take care of our family. You know, people are genuinely good and it doesn't matter where you go. Like I mentioned before, I've been to Iran. I spent 2 weeks in Iran. I've been to El Salvador. I spent weeks in Zimbabwe. I've been to North Korea, for God's sakes. Like, if you can't think of a more random, weird place in the world, trust me, it's North Korea. I went to Cuba while Castro was still in power. I went to Colombia while there was, you know, while it was still in civil war, and I had an amazing time and met amazing people there. The world is genuinely a good place, and I encourage the listeners today to do a little bit of soul searching and think, you know, where is that one place? Where is that place that they have always dreamed of going? And I don't know if you've ever told people your dreams, if you've ever shared with your family or your parents or your spouse or your friends, you know, I would always like to go to X. I would always like to go to this place. You know, I don't know if you've ever done this before. if you've shared it, but even if you haven't shared it, I know that everybody has a place that they really want to explore. And my invitation to you today is just to go out there and try, see what it's like. Go for an extended holiday, you know, rent your place out or don't, you know, just lock your door, get your neighbor to check on your place and get an Airbnb and go somewhere for a month or 6 weeks and just see what life is like. I think that there's a lot to be said for that. I think that we learn so much when we challenge ourselves and experience things firsthand, not just sitting behind a computer screen or watching things on Netflix or even reading a book. And I'm a big fan of books. I've literally read several thousand books in my life. Nothing is the same as actually touching it and smelling it and tasting it and meeting people and shaking their hands and having a conversation with the locals. You know, make up your own decisions, make up your own mind. Don't listen to the media and don't just fucking believe everything that you see online. You know, like, sorry to get a little bit upset, but you know, I get a little bit passionate. I get a little bit emotional when I hear people who are, you know, have these things that they want to do in their life, but they're not taking the leap because of some false belief pattern that they have, because of some, you know, limiting belief where they think that they can't do it. You can, I promise you, you can. If I can do it, some kid who had a learning disability and dropped out of high school, trust me, if I can do it, sure as shit, you can do it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
100% amen to that. Absolutely. It's a very common thing to say. I'd say it's a very common thing to say that in terms of, if I can do it, you can do it. Because I say the same thing. You know, if I can write books, if I can own property, real estate, if I can, you know, I'm a bit behind 104 countries as you've been to at the time of recording. I've done 47, I think it is now. You know, the getting out there and about and traveling around and about, staying in different places, it just feels so liberating. And, you know, within the property sphere, not just in the UK, but worldwide, as you know, it's the mindset's incredibly important, and you need to have that positive can-do attitude and go out there and do what you want to do. It's you know, nothing's stopping you. You just got to take that first step. And
well, 47 countries is a lot, Robert. 47 countries is a lot. So good for you for getting out there and experience, man. And I bet you, and you know, although we just became friends, I would guess that 47 countries has really shaped who you are as a human being and really helped cement some of your ideas. And I bet you've had some pretty darn amazing experiences out there traveling and experiencing life overseas.
Absolutely. And I do want to write a book on that, thinking about it, once I've polished off the next couple of property ones. Because, yeah, traveling changed me as a person. It sounds like it's obviously done wonders for you as well, Mikhail. And yes, we both of us can sit here and urge people to go and do it. You know, don't worry about these little things. Don't worry about it. Go out there and experience what you've always wanted to experience. It's it is very, very liberating once you're out of your own country.
Well, and then just to tie things back to the property markets, you know, on this online summit that I brought up before, you know, not half, but I'd say a quarter of the speakers are developers who are building properties overseas. So we've got, you know, guys who are building properties in all the way from Belize and Brazil and Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Mexico. You know, I'm friends with a lot of the guys who do the development. And this is just such an opportune time to scoop up foreign real estate and foreign properties at a discounted price. You know, and on the conference, we're going to talk not just about those products, but also how you can structure your investments so that you'll be lowering your taxes, how to put it inside a company or a foundation or a trust, how to use debt to finance these types of things. You know, I'm friends with the guys who actually own the offshore bank account that does the financing for projects, you know, or the VP who actually works on the day-to-day for offshore bank accounts who offer mortgages to foreigners to buy property overseas. Like, that's type of information that you're not going to find anywhere else. But, you know, and this kind of tails goes back to our question about, you know, common beliefs that people have that are maybe not truly there. And it's a lack of resources or a lack of resourcefulness, you know? And I would definitely argue it's the second, you know? It's not that they don't know what to do or they don't know how to do it. It's just about putting in the effort to educate themselves and where you go for this type of information. So that's why, you know, I talk about these things. My market is very niche. It is very tailor-made for investment. Now, if a lot of your listeners are just investing in, you know, down the street fix and flips, you know, maybe this is not the best thing. But if you want to diversify your portfolio, if you're looking to be involved in alternative currencies, you know, if you want to own properties in, you know, many different currencies, you know, to add a little bit of stability to your portfolio, you know, this is a good opportunity to do that because of what's happened in the coronavirus. You know, you're scooping up land for pennies on the dollar, and we're going to show you how to do all of that.
Let's go into, I think it's the third time we brought the summit up. Let's go a bit more into that. What else is the summit doing? You mentioned it's the 1st of June. Is there anything else that you are presenting, and how do people go about signing up for the summit on the 1st of June?
Yeah, absolutely. I am super, 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 super pumped about this summit. This is like my baby, okay, Robert? Like, I've put my heart and soul into this over the last 5 months. This is not just something that's been whipped together. You know, and it's kind of funny too, because there are lots of conferences around the world for the offshore markets, and I speak at a lot of them. I know all the presenters. I travel internationally to speak at events. Lots of the events cost $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 to get tickets. But a lot of those people who run those types of conferences now have to pivot, and they want to now put their conference online. But it's something they've never done before. Now, I started planning my summit already as a 100% digital product, digital conference, way before we even knew what was going on with the coronavirus, before travel stopped and airport closures and social distancing and all of this other stuff. So right off the bat, it's going to be very different then. Second of all, I have spent my life building up my professional network. The people that I get on this summit are some of the highest caliber speakers and thought leaders in the offshore space, offshore and expat space. So we have lawyers on there who charge anywhere from $1,200 to $1,500 an hour. You know, we've got the CEOs of the development companies who, you know, some of these guys are very good friends of mine who I've gone out and had dinner and drinks with dozens of times. You know, one of the guys is a very good friend and mentor of mine. He's built properties, like, I mean, Marriott's, like giant hotels and residencies and resorts and golf courses. He's the founder and CEO. I'm on the phone with him several times a week asking him questions. And, you know, that's where I learn a lot of my information. He's going to be a speaker. I have John Perkins, who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which sold, I don't know, 30 million copies. He's a personal friend of mine. He's agreed to come on and be a speaker for the event. You know, there's some really, really top level speakers. And actually, you can watch any of the presentations as they air live for free. So, you know, there's really nothing stopping you guys. And I know that you're going to have a link to the summit. It's called Offshore Escape. The link will be on your website where people will be able to get a hold of it to opt in. And, you know, if you like the content, if you think that it's really good and you want to own the content for life, like lifetime access to the recordings and the transcripts and the audio only files, plus just a whole host of other bonuses, including a free consultation. And I'm so stoked about this one, so excited about this one. An actual free legal consultation with an offshore lawyer who has been very generous to donate his time to the paid people. You can actually get access to all the bonus materials and the recordings for what I would say is a very, very reasonable fee. But if you just want to come and poke your head in and you're not really sure, is this for you? Is it not for you? You know, you can watch as many of the recordings as you can when they air June 1st for free. And, you know, it's going to go on. We got 5 speakers a day for 5 days straight, plus a little bit of bonus content. So, you know, we're talking 25, 30 hours of stuff that normally if I was going to go to in person would cost $3,000-$4,000 for the ticket, and plus my airfare, plus my hotel, plus my food, you know, $10,000, you're going to get it for, either free or a couple $100. So, you know, if that doesn't sell you, then I don't know what will. But I mean, I'm super excited about it. I can't wait for it to happen. I'm really excited.
Especially as you've put, as you say, so much time and effort into it. It sounds absolutely fantastic. And as you say, we'll put notes in the show notes for this episode, but also do a special blog post as well, guiding people to that. It sounds like it's going to be packed full of really, really useful content. And you know, most people are either been furloughed or are watching a lot of Netflix. So, you know, this might provide a fantastic opportunity for them to expand their knowledge. And of course, many people that have been thinking about moving country or doing something, again, sounds like there's going to be so much content there to be able to help them. So really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's worthwhile to get the recordings, because with a lot of these presentations, you're not going to want to watch it once. You're going to watch it twice or three times. I mean, this stuff is going to blow your mind. This is the really in-depth things. If you like anything that we're talking about, basically, okay, if you're interested in investing in overseas real estate, offshore incorporation, offshore banking, second passport, second residency, overseas gold storage, learning multiple languages. Basically, if you want to be Jason Bourne, this is the summit that is going to teach you how to do it. You know, I hate to be like hypey and markety, but I mean, really, like, you're going to want to see this stuff. It's about as high value as you can possibly get.
Absolutely. I don't doubt that one bit, to be honest with you, Mikhail. I was a bit lost for words there, trying to think of the next thing to say. In terms of a couple of things before we wrap up, in terms of Expat Secrets book, I just want to touch through a couple of other subjects that you've got in there. You talk about cryptocurrencies, talking about Bitcoin, but mentioning the summit being completely online, what gave the idea of making it completely online in the first place? Is that because you can see a trend of people wanting information quicker and people wanting it in, you know, I'll do my bunny ears, in the comfort of their own homes? And do you see that is a growing trend, that more and more is being done online, and that is a place to be in order to sort of live this lifestyle?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm sure if you look at the statistics for most summits or conferences around the world, they've seen a steady decline in in-person attendance. You know, I've been to lots of business and marketing summits that, you know, 10 years ago would have had 1,000 people there, and now we've got 400. You know, that's pretty drastic. But it's because there's so much information online, and so much of it is free. Now, a lot of people think, well, I can just get all this stuff for free. I can listen to podcasts or read blog posts and, you know, YouTube. I can learn everything I want on YouTube. Listen, I make YouTube and I write blogs and I have a daily newsletter and a podcast myself. And all of those are great things. But if you want to learn one thing really specific, you need to go through a organized course that is going to walk you A to B to Z, you know, or you need to work with someone who's going to do coaching for you one-on-one. But I see that a lot of the thing is going online, that attendance rate is dropping from in-person events. And I also think that with really dense content, and I use dense not in a negative connotation, but in a positive one, in really high value content like this, you need to see it more than once. It's just the truth. One of my very good friends and mentors, Joel Nagel, you know, he's been an international lawyer for 31 years. He was the ambassador to Austria. You know, I've visited him at his house in Austria and spent time with him there, and I'm on the phone with him every day. I've traveled around the world with him and gone to presentations, and we speak on the same stage. And I've seen his presentation 6-8 times. I do this stuff for a living, and I learn stuff from him every single time. Now, if I'm learning stuff on the 6th or 8th time, there is just no way that you guys are going to be able to learn this stuff one go around. And I don't mean that in any type of insulting manner. I just mean this stuff is really, you know, you need to be in the right place. Even if you hear a presentation today, maybe, you know, in 6 months, you're going to be in a different position. You know, other little light bulbs will have gone off in your head, and you'll be looking at things in a different light, and you're going to pick up more information. That's why when you go online and you get the recordings and you have it, you know, you can come back to it, or you watch a presentation, but you just need that one word. What was that one thing he said, if you can pull up the transcript for it and scroll through it and find that phrase and use that phrase to put into Google and research about that specific law or process or loophole, you know, maybe that's the thing that's going to make you $10,000 or save you $100,000 or make you $1 million. I don't know what it is, you know, but I think that that is really valuable by doing these types of things online.
Definitely is. Any form of education along those lines is valuable. I mean, I just looking at my bookshelf, I've got, obviously, podcast purposes, you can't see this, but I'm telling you, it's behind me. You know, I look at some of the books I've got and I've read them multiple times because there's always some nugget of information somewhere that you can pick up and go to. And as you say, by having those assets, you know, that information is going to be there. It's going to be crucial to keep going back to. One last thing. And I note a few things. I listen to a lot of books on geopolitics, macroeconomics. A lot of people talking about gold and how Russia and China are buying up a lot of the gold reserves and, you know, bits and pieces going on there. But you've got quite an interesting story about visiting a secret offshore gold vault in Singapore. Tell us about that experience and then give us a bit of your thoughts on the gold market at present.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I could consider myself a gold bug. I do own a lot of other investments. You know, I own real estate overseas and I own real estate in China and lots of different investments around the world. But gold, I think, is a very important part of any portfolio in the world. But yeah, I've traveled to probably a half a dozen different countries and gone to, you know, secret underground gold vaults. I've been to multiple ones in Austria and Germany and Switzerland. And one of my favorite ones these days is actually based out of Panama here. But a couple of years ago, I went to Singapore. I lived in Singapore back in, I want to say 2010. I lived there. But I had a friend who came on the podcast and I had a guest who came on the podcast and we became friends after that. And he owns a private vault in Singapore. And he said, you know, why don't you come on down and take a look? I want to show you what we do. And so I took a flight over from Abu Dhabi to Singapore and I had a TV crew meet me there and at the vault. And, you know, it was pretty amazing. The CEO of the company and the founder of this company spent 3 hours and, you know, me and the TV crew went around and walked through this place. But this was just unreal. So we showed up. It was in a nondescript building with no signage, no nothing. The place didn't even show up on Google Maps. I was using, not Uber, but whatever it is, Grab or something like that in Singapore. And it took us like twice as long to find the place because there was no proper address. So then we had to go through a little security at the front, you know, that's before we got into the parking lot. And then the guy met me out front and we went through a big locked vault door, not vault door, but like secure door. And the door closed behind us. And then there's multiple people behind bulletproof glass. And it was weird because the door is kind of like in an L shape. And then there's another massive door there. But this second door wouldn't open until the first door was first of all closed and locked. And we surrendered our passports to the security. And they're all behind the bulletproof glass. And, you know, you can't just pop in there. You need to be registered in advance. And even the owner, the founder, you know, was not allowed through without doing these security procedures. So then we go through and we get mic'd up and, you know, the cameras are working and we have to leave all the rest of our belongings and we start touring this place. And it's like not even a vault. I swear to God, it's like a warehouse. They've taken a warehouse and turned it into a vault through, you know, like a meter, I don't know the exact number, but say like a meter thick concrete on the walls and like L2 and L3 vault doors. And you walk inside and it is stacked about 30 feet high with silver. As far as you can see, giant aisles of 30 kilogram bars of silver, like floor to ceiling on these racks. And I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like $400 million in silver is privately stored at this vault. And he went through everything. He went through how to assay it, how to test it, all the different methods, the security features. He talked about, you know, the seismic, that's not the right word. Something like that. The vibration that they detect in the walls, the infrared, you know, if someone tries to come through the ventilation, then this will trip. If someone tries to drill through the walls or through the floor, this will trip. And then inside of the warehouse vault, there is another vault, which is just for gold. And I've got these pictures of me holding these like 10, 12 kilogram bars of gold. And I think at the time they were each worth about $500,000. So I just thought this was like the coolest thing in the world. And I've got like pictures of me like pretending to like bite the bar of gold, to check if it's real, you know, just joking around. But I'm like a kid in a candy shop here, you know? But this kind of like spurred my interest in a lot of the private security and gold vaults. So like I said, I've been to Austria and Germany and Switzerland and actually all over the UAE. I've been to vaults there as well. And now I've been to not once or twice or five times or 10 times, but probably 20 times to a vault here in Panama called Fort Kobe. And I got to become really good friends with them. And they've got very similar security measures. But what they have, which no one else seems to have, is because they're located in the Panama Canal Zone, it's still defended by the U.S. military. So literally on site, there is a battalion, a U.S. battalion who is on site, who is legally obliged to protect the vault if there is anything. So the armed response is like, and I don't think I'm going to get in trouble by sharing any of these secrets, but basically the armed response is on site, there is an armed guard, you know, automatic weapons. Then within 2 to 4 minutes, there will be people on motorcycles that will come with automatic weapons. And then there is the Panama Pacifica private security force, which is 100, 150 people. Then on top of that is the police station. And then on top of that is the battalion of U.S. troops that all protect this area. So it is like crazy fortified. And because these guys are my friends, they allow me in and let me walk the place. And, you know, I've had multiple tours, and usually a tour of somewhere like this might take 45 minutes. But with me, because I ask so many questions and I'm so curious, it takes like, I don't know, 3 hours or 4 hours. But yeah, there's some really cool places in the world. The one in Singapore is really good. The one here in Panama, Fort Kobe, is excellent. I work directly with both of those vaults and some other ones. You know, you can reach out to me at the podcast at expatmoneyshow.com or escapeartist.com. And, you know, I can set you up with any of those guys. If you want to purchase precious metals, if you need anything to do with the logistics, if you need to do with the storage. But it's also, you know, even if you have cryptocurrency and it's controlled on, if it's held on a cold wallet, we can store those types of things in safety deposit boxes or fine art or corporate documents or anything like that. Anything that you need to keep ultra, ultra, ultra secure, you do through one of these types of facilities. And it's not part of the banking sector. It is completely private. Government has no right to intrude. They cannot just demand access no matter what under any circumstances. So yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. I love this kind of stuff. I totally geek out on it. I think it's really cool.
Oh yeah, join a club. It's yeah, absolutely join a club. This is, you know, when I listen to various gold you know, podcasts and bits and pieces, where it's a key thing people always say is, if you're gonna buy bullion or you're gonna buy sovereigns or Britannicas in the UK or whatever, you know, make sure you physically own it and that it's in a, you know, safe storage area that's not in the bank. Because if there is economic Armageddon, you know, you want to have access to.
Yeah. No fractional ownership. Fractional ownership, yep, is bullshit. Yep. Fractional ownership is not worth anything. You know, ETFs are not bullion. ETFs are not gold. They're securities, they're equity. You know, don't think of, you know, a mining stock or the GLD ETF on the New York Stock Exchange as, you know, your percentage that has gone into bullion. That is not the case. That goes under the securities, equities portion of your portfolio. You have to keep those types of things in mind.
Yeah, it's having an active portfolio does take a, you know, a lot of learning and a lot of keeping on top of things. But again, it's one of those, you know, you obviously really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. You know, hopefully more people will see the light. Mikhail, just polish off a random question that sprung to mind, because I recently watched a TV program about Fort Knox. Do you think Fort Knox is empty, or do you think the US government are hiding something there?
That's a difficult one. You know, I work with a lot of really high-end gold people. And it's kind of like, I don't know about conspiracy theory, but a lot of people do believe that it is empty and a lot of people don't, you know. Do I think the U.S. government lies to us? Yes, absolutely. Every day, every word, not like every other word, but like every word that they say is a lie. They're all scum and we need to drain the swamp. Are they lying about this one? Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's hard to say. They don't have it. They don't have independent assays. They don't have independent accounting or anything done. Really, we just have to believe what is there. Like, what they say is there is actually there. You know, with a private vault, you know, they're independently audited. You know, at least for the allocated. You know, if you have a safety deposit box, obviously that is private. But for the segregation and the allocation, you know, those things are audited. And, you know, if you put a bar in and it has your serial number on it and you go to get it in 10 years, sure as shit, you're going to get your bar back. You know, what they say is there. There's no question about that. With a lot of those types of reports, you can find the information online. Now, you can find your serial number. Obviously, they're not going to publish your actual name that is connected to that serial number. But in some type of a portal, they'll be able to see how much gold and silver or platinum or palladium or any other rare earth metals that are held in the vault are actually on site. You know, Fort Knox, I don't know. I'm not sure about that one. Do I think the U.S. government is lying about things? Yes, definitely. Kind of leave it at that, I guess, and make your own decision.
It's not like governments to lie to us, is it? we can go for hours and hours and hours. Really, 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 we could. Definitely, I think round two at some point would be a significant value. Just to not just summarise everything we've gone from, but in terms of where people can find you, the summit on the 1st of June, as much information as you can give. As I said, we'll do a blog post. It's check out the Property Nomad's social medias, my social medias as well. We'll put all the show notes and everything and links into the into the show notes. But where can people find you? What course of action do they need to take?
Yeah, absolutely. So like we mentioned on your show notes at Property Nomad's website, you're going to have a URL which will go directly to the summit. The summit is huge. It's going to be massive. It's going to be super cool. Now, if you are listening to this episode and it is past June 1st, don't worry. You can still get access to the recordings and everything like that. The link will still be on Property Nomads and you're going to be able to follow through. If you want to just check out some of the other stuff that I do, check out my podcast, The Expat Money Show, which is expatmoneyshow.com. I've had some really cool people on there, like Jim Rogers, you know, multiple Guinness Book of World Records, 5-time, 6-time New York bestselling author, a gentleman who's inspired me greatly. You know, I have an amazing conversation with him on there that people just lost their mind when they heard this conversation. I've had people like Grant Cardone, certifiable billionaire who owns, 6,000 apartments, something like that, and runs REITs and owns $30 million jet, $50 million jet, I can't remember, that he pays cash for. And he tells me the story how he bought his Gulfstream cash. So that's pretty funny. And then Escape Artist. EscapeArtist.com is the oldest offshore website in the world. I run a daily newsletter that you can subscribe to for free. You know, we talk about a lot of the things that we covered today, but in a lot more detail, overseas investments, you know, a lot of the things that I touch on in my book, Expat Secrets, How to Pay Zero Taxes, Live Overseas, and Make Giant Piles of Money. Yes, very humble title, I know. You can get that on Amazon. I know that's a ton of information and people, I probably just confused everyone. But go to Robert's website and he'll have all the links there for you.
Definitely, 100%. Mikhail, really, thank you very much for your time. Really insightful, packed full of great content. Look forward to round two.
Perfect. Thanks so much for your time, brother. Take care.